720 WGN. Amy Guth in for Patty Vasquez with you till 2 o'clock. We're hanging out. We got all kinds of stuff to talk about tonight. But first, you know what? Can we just have a minute for the weather, please? Because it is July. It is the first week of July, almost the second week of July. And I believe I just heard 56 at O'Hare and 58 at the lakefront.
Yeah, Rob said something with fives. Yeah. It started with 50-something?
Yeah, no.
That doesn't make any sense.
I wore a coat and a hoodie to the studio tonight, which I find completely unacceptable for July.
This is the end of it, though, right? It's only like, this is like a one-day cool-down, right? And then it gets better? It's going to be like 95 tomorrow.
That's what they promised us all June. All June, and we saw how that turned out.
Yeah.
June, also now known as April.
And it is fall. I thought that the leaves were going to start changing colors. I don't know what's happening.
One of my plants did that. The weather faked it out. And this morning I was looking at my little plants, and this one has little yellow leaves. I'm like, no. It's fake.
It's not. Just don't worry.
Shh. No. You're okay.
You'll be fine.
Shh. It's fine.
We'll all be okay.
See, I have. Are you a gardening person?
I like plants.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't garden often.
I don't have a lot of room to do so. Yeah. So I'm all about the container gardening. But I have a lot of plants this year. I have a very prolific blueberry plant.
Ooh.
Raspberries. I have all the herbs and lots of tomatoes and peppers and all kinds of stuff like that. The blueberries are just starting to happen. And now they're like, wait.
We don't think so. This doesn't really seem.
Wait a minute. Should we? You want us to go? Yeah. I hate it. It drives me crazy.
It doesn't make any sense. Why is this happening? It's Tom Skilling's fault, is what a lot of people will say.
I love Skilling.
Skilling is wonderful, and he understands the blame, but it's usually his fault when something bad happens, right? He controls the weather?
I've asked him about that. I said, does that bother you how people really legitimately think you control the weather? He's like, well, they really do. and it doesn't bother him, but he's a good sport about it, but he is certainly aware of how many people go, hey, buddy, can you know, my kid's birthday is this weekend.
Right.
Can you make the weather nice?
Just and he's get like, get a little bit nicer.
I have no control over that whatsoever.
It'd be cool to see him do like a rain dance or something, though, if we asked for it, to really try to lean into that. Maybe, yeah.
What I love about Skilling is that he, when you hear him talking about a large weather event, mm-hmm. When it's coming in, and we don't know how it's going to unfold yet, but he's seeing like the blizzard and, you know, stuff like that. He is so darn excited. And you can just tell he has so much passion and joy for what he does. You're like, that guy was put on this earth to talk about weather.
Right.
And you know it, and you can tell it. And I think that's awesome.
I can see baby Skilling really caring about weather.
Yeah.
Little tiny Skilling.
Yeah,
right.
Totally you can. There is, he did a documentary special about storm chasers. And he went out with them. And there is a wonderful scene in which he is sitting in the rear passenger side of a SUV. The camera person is sitting in the passenger side pointing the camera at him because Skilling's got his head kind of out the window. He turns around. There is a giant tornado barreling down the road at them. Okay. And you and I would say things we can't say on the radio if we saw that. And we would haul ass away from that tornado. However, what Skilling does is he looks at it and gets wide-eyed, like in the way that if you like say to a dog, you know, go outside, outside, outside. He gets really like, wah, and then looks at the camera. And he goes, golly. And he's so excited. Like, this is a thing we're doing. And you're like, he was put on this earth to just be into weather. That's his superpower.
Amen. And he really should lean into controlling it, I think. I think he should study some of that stuff and maybe help us turn this into a nicer summer. If anybody can do it, Tom Skilling can.
It is Skilling. And I beseech him.
I believe
to
in
begin
Skilling.
Doing so now. Let's start a campaign.
Right. Let's do it.
Let's start a hashtag campaign. Skilling save us.
Skilling saves the day.
Because this is, I think it's interesting how weather will influence other stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. most, like, famously, right, the summer of the very macabre British literature, like when Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein and all mm-hmm. that, in her diary she was talking about how it was snowing in early June in England. No.
Ooh. So are you starting a book then?
I'm finishing.
You should be penning a book right now.
I'm finishing book two.
Ooh.
It's been in the works for a long time. It felt like book one came out just a minute ago. No, it came out 9 years ago. get off it, Guth. Get going. Anyway, my friends, we have got to take a break. We've got to do all the fun stuff. And when we come back, we are talking with Chicago author Ben Tanzer. It's going to be super awesome. You're definitely going to want to stick around for that. 720 WGN. WGN, Amy Guth in for Patty Vasquez. Thanks for joining us this fine, fine evening. And even though I say that, it is in the 50s outside, but we're not going to talk about that because it's July and that seems ridiculous. What we are going to talk about, my friends, is we have a very special guest in studio with us because only the best for you, listeners, dear. We're joined by Chicago author Ben Tanzer. Welcome.
Hi there, Amy Guth. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad that you're here. You write so much stuff. Every time I turn around, you've got a new book coming out, it seems like. Your first book, Lucky Man, came out in 2006.
2007, I think that's when we met, right?
Yes, right around the same time, because mine was the very end of 2006, and then you were like the beginning of 2007.
Such a good book.
In that time, you have so many books, so very many books. You've written so many books, and you're on a wonderful roll. So I want to start with the most recent one and kind of backtrack from there. Tell us about the new book.
Sure. Thanks so much. And again, thanks for having me. I'm really thrilled about it. The new book is a short story collection called The New York Stories, and it is comprised of sort of three mini collections I've done over the last 10 years, starting back in 2007 when I first met you. Each of the sections, the stories intersect with characters in the same town, and the same bars and restaurants. And you know, I did these in three groups, and now they've all come together, sort of 30-plus stories over this last decade.
When you started on the second volume that became this three-part series, had you planned to make them all intersect? Was that the plan all along?
Well, no. I mean, the funny and probably embarrassing part is that I was not getting anything published at all, like no nibbles, no nothing. And I was reading all these books, though, I really enjoyed When the Messenger is Hot by Elizabeth Crane and Drown by Juno Diaz and What We Talk About When We Talk About Love by mm-hmm. Raymond Carver. And I thought, you know, maybe what I need to do is do a collection like theirs, like a group of stories that sort of hang together. Maybe that'll make a difference. So it didn't. That went nowhere. But after Lucky Man came out, I did connect with the Chicago Center for Literature and Photography, which is a local publisher, and they were really excited about Lucky Man. And I said, you know, I've got this group of stories that never went anywhere. So at the time, it seemed like a one-shot deal. They liked the whole group. But a couple of years after that, they were having me do some interviews about the book, even though it had been out for a while, the mini collection. And I got a bunch of ideas for new stories. And I started seeing that not only did that first group of stories, not only could they hang together, but maybe you could sort of keep playing it out. I could keep playing it out. So then I did a second set. And then a couple of years ago, I made a very dumb joke about how if, you know, Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy would ever do a third movie in the Before Sunset series, I would do a third collection too. And literally, maybe 4 or 5 days later, Ethan Hawke, who I do idolize a bit too much, was doing an interview and he said, hey, we just finished the third script for what became Before Midnight. And I thought, here we go. And so
it's on.
Yes, it was so on. So he doesn't know that. And I'm sure Clapp, the Center for Literature and Photography, was not that thrilled about it. But I thought, let's do another thing. I got another thing.
Yeah, you have to be a man of your word.
I do.
You know, what's very cool about Chicago Center for Literature and Photography is it has long been a place of, obviously a lot of local support of local authors and Midwestern authors. But also, it's always been very risk tolerant. I mean, even early on, that first, very creatively done kind of a book released Radiohead style with kind of a pay what you want sort of feel to it. So they've always been very, you know, it seems like very, Jason Pettis there has been very embracing of, you know, let's try something new, let's try something different. And so what, as you have gone along with, through your writing career thus far and the places where it's touched Chicago Center for Literature and Photography, how has that, that kind of creative freedom sort of influenced you?
Oh, it's such a great question. And, you know, I really want to say I'm very attracted to people who hustle and take risks and, you know, present company excluded. I always thought Jason was always trying to be smart and creative and innovative. I think what's been inspiring about that relationship is that if I have an idea that builds on the previous idea, I know he'll be interested. And there's mm-hmm. a certain kind of freedom. You know, you are a published author of an absolutely terrific novel. And
Thank
I think
you.
Even, you know, you would appreciate that even when you feel successful, the next book involves another amount of hustle. There's no guarantees. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of cool to know that someone who's a good editor and will push back if they don't like something is still going to be very interested in anything you pitch. And for me, I don't know if I speak for other authors, it's kind of exciting to know that someone is interested in you if you can figure out what they're interested in. That's not always the case. And so that gives you a certain amount, it gives me a certain amount of freedom to try to run with some ideas.
For sure. So talk a bit about, you know, the setting as you were writing through these stories that became New York stories. A lot of them are kind of I don't want to say it's autobiographical, but, you know, some degree of this kind of fictional town in New York, but that very much mirrors your own childhood. And so how much did you feel, you know, did you make it a fictional town because you wanted to take some creative liberties, or did you really just kind of do that to protect the innocent there?
Well, luckily, you know, it's fictional enough where nobody, I don't think anybody could pick it up and say, wow, I wish he'd done a better job of protecting me. I think I just thought, what would this town look like? And so, you know, I started with slivers, bars I went to, diners we hung out in, and then the rest of it becomes sort of an act of imagination. So really, it's fictional because the town I grew up in, which I quite love and I'm endlessly nostalgic for, was a certain platform or a leaping off point. Mm-hmm. And so it's fictional because really the characters are fictional. A lot of how I describe the town is literally what it looked like when I was growing up there. So what's really fictional is sort of the collective idea of what's happening there and who lives there. And, you know, any one of the stories, even the 30 plus stories, you could probably find a sliver or a sentence that's absolutely nonfiction. But of course, with fiction, I hope what you do is you take something that's stuck in your head and you spin out a larger piece about it. So That's where it becomes fictional.
And did you do the same for characters where you had kind of hybrid composites of different people that became one character?
Yeah, absolutely. Or even just an idea about a story that needed a character, right? Mm-hmm. So there is a story about my father and I where we shot pool together when I was maybe my son's age, my older son, or maybe my younger son. When I was like 9 or 10, we went to the really scary arcade downtown and we shot pool and we were beating everybody, mainly because he's an unbelievable pool player. But I hit the winning
shot. And nobody wants to beat a 10-year-old at pool.
You'd be shocked. Apparently in upstate New York, teenagers are thrilled to beat on 10-year-olds on the pool table anyway. But what's funny is I literally did sink the winning shot in the third game when they matched up the best team they could come up with, which happened to be these two girls in acid wash jeans. And, you know, my dad told that story for years, how I sank the winning shot. I'd missed every shot up to that point. That's a good story. The rest of the story I wrapped around it has nothing to do with me or my dad, You know? And so I took a really very real incident, which was in a way a terrifying thing for me going into this arcade. But nothing about it is, after that, it's all in from my head. Mm-hmm. The strain of the relationship between the father and son, that's really the moment. That's the one moment they have. Of course, my father and I is the opposite. We have a million moments. That just happens to be the one that sounded like would be a good story.
Mm-hmm. That was the starting point. Isn't that so interesting, though? I mean, with my first book, it skews a bit violent. It's a weird little book,
right? I picked up on that.
Right? But you know what? So people say things like, oh, that book's so violent. You must be really dark.
Right.
And I always have to remind them, you know, that's one story that I started one day of my life. And that 1 minute started that one story. And that is not me. That's a piece of something that was in my head in that one day. What things in your books do people pick up on about you and assume that's part of you?
That's a great story. So, okay, so one of the things that's interesting is that the story I just referenced, part of the tension the son and the father have, so the father's an alcoholic. And then that story is in the first collection of the collection. And then the son and father relationship carries through for the next two collections. My father, like the character, this won't give anything away. You know, the father dies eventually in those stories. I also am the son of a dead father and I'm endlessly tangling with that. But that character was an alcoholic and he didn't live at home and he was homeless and he needed the son and sometimes to support him. That's not my father at all. But one time, and it may be more than this story, but I had a friend and she was like, I'm glad we have that dad thing in common. I go, it is hard, you know, because we were younger than I thought. Most of our friends don't have a dead father. And I go, that is good to have that with someone. And she goes, well, I mean the alcoholic thing. Mm. And I thought, no, my dad had this horrible form of cancer. I mean, my dad barely ever had a drink my entire life and he wasn't a teetotaler. And so I thought, wow. Either she had read the story or we had talked about it. And so that was one thing that has come up. Other things that have come up, which is sort of more embarrassing, but I'm sure my wife's already asleep. But, you know, the characters are, you know, they make poor choices, I think, especially in relationships. And I've always been like so scared and tightly wound around that, that mm-hmm. I don't know what people assume, but there's always questions about, you know, adultery and how far you'll sort of bend your marriage or your relationship for your own entertainment. And I'm quite the opposite of that. I'm extremely tightly wound, but those make for interesting stories and what people are willing or not willing to do. So some of that comes up. And what is funny though, and it's usually men, if there's any true element in any story that involves anything remotely sexual, but it's the one true thing, some guy will eventually say, "So that really happened?" I go, "That is the one thing that happened in that entire story. And I guess you seized on it. Somehow mm-hmm. you knew. Maybe we were at the same high school."
Nice. Oh, my gosh. Okay, my friends, we are talking with author Ben Tanzer. He's local. He's a Chicago guy. He's written so many books. What are we up to now? Like 9?
God, I hope not. That sounds terrible when you say it like that. I don't know.
You've written a ton of books.
Maybe, yes.
You have the written last, circles around me.
The last 7 years have been very good. Since we met, maybe you were good luck. We didn't even know at the time.
I guess. I'm a good
Thank
luck charm.
Thank you for that.
Well, you know what?
You started it.
Ben, I have long said that, you know what? Our first books came out about the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I met you at that time, and we were both kind of like jumping in and figuring it all out and learning about all the reading series in town and how to promote our own books without being a complete jerk and all those things. And just kind of making a go of all of this author racket. I feel like you helped me a ton, and we traded a lot of information in that time, and I've always appreciated that.
That's
very
true.
Much.
I would love that. You were literally, and I actually said this on the way over here, or as I was getting into the cab zip over here because we had a reading tonight, you are literally one of the first authors I ever met.
Look at that.
And I always tell people this, which is not to embarrass you, but you become part of the story.
Oh, no.
You know, I was always a voracious reader, mm-hmm. and I was not, you know, people say, well, I started writing as a fifth grader or whatever they say. That was not me. I mean, up until 30, I didn't even write a sentence, you know, but I always read. I read so mm-hmm. much. And for years, one of my fantasies was not meeting athletes or other kinds of celebrities, so that would be cool. I always wanted to meet writers, and it was kind of funny. It never occurred to me that, you know, if you become a writer, that's one way to do that. So, you know, really, until
that's probably
Lucky
the fastest
Man,
way to do that.
Apparently, I had no idea. I wasn't that smart. But what's funny is when Lucky Man came out, that really, I always tell people, you know, a book really does open certain doors. It certainly opened the door to meeting you and other people. And I thought, wow, I get to meet authors now. And it was, I'm still sort of in shock and in awe about the whole thing. I mean, I'm really appreciative.
Look at that. We got some warm fuzzies happening here.
I am all about
the showcase studio.
That's true.
All right, my friends, we got to take a quick break. We got to go to news and do all that fun stuff. And when we come back, more talking with author Ben Tanzer, because he's got so many books. We got to talk through all of them. It'll be all good. 720 WGN. Been 20 WGN. Amy Guth in for Patty Vasquez, hanging out with you till 2 o'clock. My friends, we are graced with the presence of Chicago author Ben Tanzer, who's with us in studio tonight. We're hanging out. We're talking about writing. We're talking about stuff. If you have questions, comments, feel free to give us a call or text us at 312-981-7200. Or of course, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook. Have a conversation there because it's always, always going all hours. Right there on the Twitter. Okay, so right before the break, Ben, we were talking about, we were starting to talk about writing and kind of how you arrived at that. And, you know, interestingly, and it's so clear from your writing how interlaced writing and running are to you. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, they're both compulsions, I think. That's the first place to start, which is the most negative way to start. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. I think both of them help me sort of manage my day and manage my anxieties, both the ones I'm conscious of and unconscious mm-hmm. of. I mean, they really give me a way to sort of get out of my own head and, you know, sort of slough off all the stuff that I'm sort of balancing. I mean, I was literally having a conversation with someone at work today. You know, if I can get up in the morning first thing, go for a run, do some writing, the whole day is better balanced. So mm-hmm. I see it as balance. I mean, writing, and someone said this earlier, this reading we were at, for this, he was describing writing as a need. Didn't feel like it was a choice, needed to do it. And I know that feeling. I mean, the first sentence I wrote after that, the switch was flipped. You mm-hmm. know, running is similar, though. Running I've been doing since I was 13. So it's an almost everyday thing for 30-something years now. So, you know, what is it? It's a need. I think it's a balancing, and it's a way to organize my day. It's a way to organize my head. And it's a way to say, okay, I'm going to have to work today. I'm going to be dropping off kids at summer camp. And you know, I'm going to be running to a doctor's office or dealing with a bunch of meetings I don't want to deal with. And so I think it's really a way of finding a certain sort of calming, mm-hmm. and, you know, mellowness. But it also allows me to sort of clear that stuff out of my head, which is going. Well, you may or may not have this experience, but I am going all the time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways I'm not going, mm-hmm. you know.
Absolutely. And how has the – I'm endlessly fascinated by writers and their kind of their rituals and how that ritual evolves. I know for me, the way I used to write is very different than the way that I write now. And I wonder if that is the same for you, if you had early on, if you established sort of a, here are the rules of things that must be in order for me to write, and how those have changed over time.
I love that, because my answer has changed over time. What I used to say, which I still think is fairly accurate, is I got a late start. And I remember thinking, you are not going to be allowed to be precious about this, mm-hmm. right? So it can't be a certain time of day. It can't be a certain cup of coffee or a certain place in the house. You don't have time for that. You waited too long. Now you are married and you have a job. And so on the one hand, there's no real ritual. On the other hand, that's completely not accurate, because right off the bat, I remember thinking, you'll never be allowed to write for less than 30 minutes a day. Like, that became a rule. I thought, that's my running rule. That'll be my writing rule, because I didn't have another way to start. And I remember thinking, you're not just going to write in 5-minute snatches during the day, like, you know, Eminem and 8 Mile or something. Mm-hmm. That's not going to work. You're going to have to be really regimented. And then I remember thinking, it's going to have to be 7 days a week, though it's not. But that's the goal. And it doesn't have to be the same time of day, but every day I got to figure out when I'm going to be writing the next day and the day after that. So the ritual is really about sort of the slotting and the figuring out time and the fitting it in and creating an atmosphere where I know that for 30 minutes, I mean, I could be in the middle of a Starbucks, I could be on the Orange Line, I could be sitting in a terminal at O'Hare. It's not about noise or outside, but it has to be a block of time where I'm not going to have to get up and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's ritualistic in a way, but otherwise it could be a free-for-all. I've written pretty much anywhere you can imagine and done it quite happily. For sure.
I love that. I have found that to be my experience too. I used to have to really, really set it up, and it was all about the same time of day. And then, as you know, life happens and things evolve, you just get less and less into that.
I think, you know, it's very tricky, because mm-hmm. if the goal is to try to be, and this is not more judged, I mean it, if the goal is to try to be a writer,
yeah,
whatever works for you, that makes you a writer. And if you write, you're a writer. But you also have to put in the time. And I realized early on that the main ritual is going to be every day. Mm-hmm. And that you don't, or I don't, wait for inspiration. I don't wait for the story to come. I make myself sit down when I know that's my time, and I start to write and I see what happens. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I'm not ritualistic, but I'm super focused.
Often writing students or young writers that haven't been published yet will come and ask me, you know, how do I get my start? What do I do? Should I go get an MFA? Should I go do this? And I say, you know what? You need to sit your ass down and write.
Absolutely.
That's what you have to do. You could talk about it and study it for the rest of your life, and that's totally valid. But at some point, you're going to have to just sit down and write. And they always look at me like, wait, I thought you were going to give me a trick or a thing. No,
oh, I know.
You
got to sit down. Wouldn't it be great if there was a trick?
I wish there was a
trick. I need more tricks. No. You have to sit and write. And then you have to rewrite and edit. And that sounds boring, but the repetition's very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know, you know, I don't know what an MFA would look like. I've always thought that would be so cool, and I wished I had done that. But I definitely thought it's time to start. When I started, it was time to start, and I have not been able to stop. And in mm-hmm. that way, it's very much like running, and it's very much like reading. I mean, all the things that when I finally figured out how to begin them, I've not been able to stop them. Mm-hmm. So to me, they all start piling up on each other.
And so for your books that you, because you've written so many books in a relatively short period of time, was there one book that stuck out as easier to write than the others?
That's a terrific question. I would say that Lucky Man, the debut, mm-hmm. I was probably carrying most of that book around almost page by page in my head for years. And that one, I remember thinking, I had already started writing, it had only been a couple of years, but I thought, now it's time to write a novel. And I already knew the first sentence and the last sentence, more or less, and I dedicated 3 months to just that book. And in a way, that was easy. I mean, I knocked out the first draft in about 90 days. Now, literally writing every day, 90 days, sometimes not more than 30 minutes, but building. You know, one of my rules, too, is You never go back and edit during the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
You have to finish it.
That is an important rule, because
that might be my one trick or rule.
You'll drive yourself crazy with a single
sentence. I mean, you can, you know,
just
I might
get it down.
One day I might start like three paragraphs in from the day before to remember where I was. But, you know, Lucky Man rolled out. And in some ways it was the easiest. Now, I will say, which is interesting, I've never outlined, but I heard people talk about it and I got really fascinated with it. So I had a book come out about 2 years ago, Orphans, which is the first time I wrote a science fiction book, science fiction novel. And I'd always had an idea for a second and third one in my head. And I remember thinking I was going to take a break from writing, which we could do a whole other segment on, the lengthy 18-month stretch where I cranked out this unbelievable amount of work and got really anxious about how well that was going, which sounds ridiculous. But I remember taking a break purposely and then thinking, I'm going to outline the follow-up to Orphans. Because that one night in a bar, I had this breakthrough, and I thought, here it is. There's a story. And so I spent about 2 weeks just outlining what it might look like. And then when I sat down to start writing it, and this sounds so obnoxious, I'm sorry to all my fellow writers out there, I knocked out like 100 pages almost immediately. Now, again, over a couple of months, but just following the outline, it completely made sense. And now I started thinking, man, an outline would make you even more productive. What's up with that? So that is my new sort of fascination, which is actually laying out the story in advance, because I usually carry them around in my head anyway.
And so for some writers, though, they kind of feel like the outline kills it and kind of kills the flow. I tend to be a little bit
I don't know.
That.
I only tried it once, and I was floored.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I always tell this, and we have a mutual friend. Well, he might be a mutual friend, Jason Fisk, who's a writer who I love to death. One of our ongoing debates is, if you don't have pen to paper or finger to keyboard, are you actually writing?
Mm-hmm.
He considers anything involving the idea of writing, writing. And I hold out that you have to actually be somewhere writing. But what we agree on is that you're always thinking about it. I mean, I'm thinking about the thing I'm working on or the next thing. I mean, all day long, every day. Wake up thinking about it. Think about it, and I'm running, which is a really can be a wonderful intersection. But one thing I was going to say was, any book or story I sit down, I've probably been carrying most of that in my head for maybe even a year or two and just waiting for the right time for it to start going. So in that way, it's not wholly original. I'm not like, oh, what am I going to do today? I know exactly what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm. You've got it all. You got it all up there.
Somehow, loosely.
One way or another, for sure. All right, my friends, we got to take a quick